Well, my name is Brandy, and it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker of the afternoon. And I think we're going to see some beautiful slides come up from the soil just a bit and sort of really see what the rewards that can be reaped from healthy soil. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mike Fallon, University of Iowa adjunct instructor. Mike has taught prairie restoration, a field course in the UI Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. His background is a prairie landscaper with Native Landscaping, specializing in restoring native landscapes, including prairie, savanna, and woodlands. It was a natural fit for the university and for his position. Mike co-wrote the design plan for the Ashton Prairie Living Laboratory, the APLL, and helped secure permission from the Department of Athletics to restore the one-acre prototype prairie at the Ashton Cross Country Course. I feel like if you go toe-to-toe with athletics and you come out ahead, then you've got some skills somewhere in there. That's pretty good. Mike and former undergraduate Megan Lentz were awarded a grant to purchase native plant seeds for the APLL, and Prairie restoration students hand broadcast the native plant seed for 1 acre and the new 7 acre prairie restorations at the site. Mike is a strong advocate for both the ecological restoration of former and degraded native landscapes and experiential learning in living laboratories on the UI campus and in natural areas. He's also involved in the Ashton Cross Country Course BioBlitz. Next year, the 5th anniversary of this free activity, which is suitable for all ages, will be held on July 12th from 9 to 11 a.m. So please mark your calendar and help me welcome Mike.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to change the frame. We'll still be thinking about soils and biodiversity and plants. But this is not a profit-driven system. This is a system for education. And I'll go through the story of how we built a prairie restoration on the University of Iowa cross-country course called Ashton Cross Country Course, and how we're using it as an educational tool and also a tool for research. So let's get into it. Okay. We started with 1 acre. Let me go through. I'm supposed to be talking into the microphone, but I'll just sort of stretch it over this way. So we start with, like a lot of things at the university, it's a collaboration between a student and faculty and staff. Back in 2018, it's when we start looking at locations on the campus. And the student, Megan Lenz, and I started with the basic question of why don't we have prairie restorations on the campus? And where would we like to see one? And both Megan and I gushed that we'd like one right downtown at the Pentacrest. She learned that landscapes have a purpose. And the purpose of the landscape at the Pentacrest is to be, is to essentially present or sell or provide a platform for education and the aesthetics of education. It's a sacrosanct landscape. It's highly manicured, and its job is to present a view of what higher education should look like. Traditionally, and that's not really changeable. It's almost immutable. So that was the wrong place for a prairie restoration. In my fantasy world, it was the right place, but you have to be present and you have to sort of work with it. Where did we go? We went to the edge of the campus, where there are a lot fewer opinions, and the land was really not being used for much. It had been hayed, but the university had ended their contract with the farmer, and now the land was sitting unused. So we thought about a grassroots shoestring project, and we started with 1 acre, and we got permission from athletics to convert some of the existing vegetation, which was mostly non-native, to a one-acre prairie restoration. And that was a great success because Brandy's right. Athletics is maybe traditionally conservative, and it's very sports-focused, and it's not arguably that interested in biology or ecology. We had a very important player, Tony Senio, the head of athletics, and he was a bridge between the restorationists and the administration over in athletics, and he's very important. He was able to code switch between what we wanted and what they needed to hear. Very important part of the project to have Tony on board. Tony's a farmer, and he gets restoration. We also had those two people. Andrew Forbes is a biologist, and also Blake was at the Office of Sustainability. So those two were buying in and supporting the project. Since it's an educational tool, we went with 50 plus species that are endemic or native to Johnson County. And we did some research, so we really wanted a gold star. We wanted that those plants to be for students to sort of come to appreciate plants that were regionally native. And I'll get to talk about, I'll start talking about the tall grass prairie in just a little while. Let's see. Did I hit the right button? Yep. We got permission from athletics to plant an additional 7.5 acres. So there's about 8 acres of restoration at the cross country course. Again, we worked with students, volunteers, the Office of Sustainability and Environment to put in the prairie. We got grants from the student government to purchase seed from Prairie Moon. We also harvested seed from local prairie remnants. And in the vernacular, a remnant is a small portion of native prairie that is still in existence. And it has a representative genotype of plants that are native to this area. So when you're collecting seed from those remnants and you're planting that seed again, you're working to preserve what I would call a rare book library. Those plants and those genomes that are genetics that that have evolved over roughly 10,000 years. The latest development is that the new School of Earth, Environment and Sustainability, or SEAS, is going to manage the APLL. It's going to be continued to use as a place of education and research. Okay, just taking a step back, just a few basic little a basic description or a few words about prairie. I love the first part because prairie is French, and if you translate prairie, it means meadow, plain, steppe, or grassland. And I'll remind some of you that there's a famous play called Pygmalion. It got translated into a musical, My Fair Lady. You might remember the tune, "The rain in Spain falls mostly on the plain." What is a plain? It's a grassland, AKA prairie. So it is, the prairie is a grassland ecosystem or biome. And grasslands exist on many of the world's continents. Here's a little graphic on grassland biomes. What is a biome? We use biome and ecosystems somewhat interchangeably. If you're a biologist or ecologist, you'll make a distinction, but here we'll say that a biome is a large naturally occurring community of flora and fauna occupying a major habitat. Tundra, forest, jungle, savanna prairie. And in North America, we've had grasslands for a long period of time. And why do they occur? You need climatic conditions, regular occurring prescribed or naturally occurring fire. That's wildfire, which occurs naturally, prescribed fire, humans. Humans have been using fire for thousands of years. Let's say the Aboriginals in Australia, 60,000 years or so. So having mastered fire, human civilization was able to progress. Many native peoples mastered fire and allowed their civilization to progress. And they were able to work well in their areas. You need the hot, droughty rain periods. You needed perennial plants. Grasses and other plants are deep-rooted perennials. Large-scale herbivory, that's buffalo and other animals that graze. Grazing turns out to be very important. The reason the forest doesn't reoccur in sort of the UK and Scotland and other areas because of grazing. Without it, the forest would arguably come back. Relatively abundant rain and sunlight. These are some of the factors that create grasslands. The grasslands are composed of graminids, or grasses, and other herbaceous, which means non-woody plants. Those are the plants that dominate grasslands. Forests are dominated by woody plants. So make a distinction between grasslands and forests. So let's zoom in to the Midwest and Iowa and talk about the central part of the North American continent. It has been grassland for a long time, millions of years. And in Iowa, the tall grass prairie is only about 9,000 years old. You might recall that at one point, this area was impacted by glaciers. So once the glaciers receded, we went through several periods of changes in plant community. We started with Arctic and subarctic vegetation, and that went to evergreen forest, to deciduous forest, to prairie. Where did the prairie plants come from? They migrated from the south. Plants do migrate, and they migrate often by animals. The seeds will stick to the animal's feathers or fur, and over time, the plants migrate north as the climate changes. So that's how the prairie got to be. There are three flavors of prairie in this part of the world, what we call the tall grass, driven primarily by rainfall. Here in Iowa, it's about 40 inches per year. And as you move progressively west towards the rain shadow created by the Rockies, you get shorter and shorter prairie. You go from tall grass to mixed grass to short grass. Immediately east of the Rockies, the rainfall is on the order of 10 inches per year. That process is called orographic lifting. As the rain moves from the west to the east, it has to lift over the mountains, and the rain falls out of the clouds via gravity and uplift. So there's a rain shadow on the eastern side of the Rockies. So that rain shadow is a driver of vegetation. Let's keep moving. So there's a basic graphic on what we'd call the different types of prairie within the prairie east of the Rockies. It does stretch into Canada as well. We just chop it off at the border. And in Iowa, we focus on the tall grass prairie. These illustrations are useful, but I don't want you to think that they're static. The prairie changes over time, and it did change over time. So I like to use the fancy words, a shifting, chaotic mosaic, changing all the time. And this the tall grass prairie changed as a result of both naturally occurring wildfire and prescribed fire. And I should always mention the Native Americans that lived on this continent for thousands of years were a primary driver in selecting plants all across the continent. They actively managed the land. They were masters of fire. So I always want to give a tip of the hat to those people that lived here for some unknown amount of time, 15,000, 20,000, we don't really know, years before. Let's see, we've got the original tall grass prairie. You guys, if you're paying attention to this, to prairie restoration, you've seen this graphic, you heard the numbers, they're pretty stark. In Iowa, we have lost the majority of it. It's been converted. I'm not going to hammer away at that. You know that. You know the story. But we have lost a significant. There are remnants, and those remnants are again like books in a special library, and people do access those plants, and they try to regrow those plants. Often the nurseries have harvested plants from remnants, and now they sell them. And I encourage you to purchase your seed from reputable nurseries. Do not ever dig plants up from remnants, because they're far and few between, and they're pretty special. You can collect seed from them, but you typically have to get permission, and you should always leave quite a bit of seed and never take all of the seed. But tread lightly in remnants. Native plant communities of the tall grass prairie ecosystem. The prairie gets top billing. It gets the most press. But we have some other plant communities. We have the savanna. And some people who have not heard about the savanna occurring in North America are sometimes shocked. I would argue that when I say the word savanna, you often will think about Africa. Yeah. But we had savanna here. The beautiful oak forests in California are also savanna. And these are plant communities dominated by large fire tolerant trees. Trees are two broad categories, fire tolerant or intolerant. So in the historically, fire would be low intensity, and it would travel through the cured vegetation, and the thicker bark of the fire tolerant species would be able to resist damage from fire. Fire tolerant tree species have thicker bark and can resist fire. Fire intolerant species, the ones that typically grew along river corridors or riparian areas, they have fire intolerant bark, and I'll name a few, like maples and elms, ashes. The fire tolerant species tended to be our oaks and hickories. In savannas, we tended to have large open grown oaks. Bur oak is our state tree, and hickories. In the woodland, you had a mixture of the two. And then a forest does burn, but in this part of the world, it was mostly dominated by fire intolerant species. And then the stepchild of the group is the wetland, the least appreciated, but most important, not sorry, very important plant community, and probably least understood. But it also did burn. All of these are, we think about them in the Midwest as how often do they burn, and how often does fire and herbivory impact, how does it impact them, and how often does fire occur in these communities? Because those are main drivers in the community and the existence of the community, these ecological factors. And one convenient way to categorize them is by trees per acre. It's just a convenient way to just categorize them. And so prairie tends to be one tree per acre. And that's just a convenient way of categorizing them. I would argue that when you're on the landscape in a native plant community, there are these gradations that occur according to aspect and topography, and they're not as easy to sort of look at and sort of distinguish, because Mother Nature doesn't really act in straight lines, as you know. Here's a little graphic showing Iowa, and it's constructed based on notes of surveyors in about 1840. It's an imperfect illustration, but it's good to show that we used to have a lot of wetlands. The joke when I first came to Iowa was, we're the land of 10 lakes. that was not true in the past. We were the land of thousands of lakes. Where did they go, the wetlands and the lakes? They were drained to create farmland. So we had, that's a flyway with all those lakes on the Des Moines Lobe, and so we had thousands and thousands of waterfowl and birds flying through there. We also had a lot of prairie. 85%, I think, of the state was tall grass prairie. We were the tall grass prairie state. We had more tall grass prairie than any other state historically. We did have forest. We did have savanna. And so this map should be seen as just an illustration of what was there. But, and again, it wasn't static, it changed every year, but here's an example of, based on historical data, that's imperfect. I'm not gonna beat this into the ground. You know that most of the prairie was converted. We do have these pockets of remnant forest, wetland, and prairie. And of course, I'd be an advocate for creating more of it. And that's what we're going to get into at the Ashland Cross Country course. Here's a little graphic on savanna in this part of the world. We had several types of savanna. Then I want to mention native peoples again. I always spend a little bit of time giving them a tip of the hat. There's some famous paintings from that era showing Native Americans burning regularly and using fire as for many reasons. These are just a few examples. The story I tell my students to help sort of make it a little bit more real is in the later part of the season, you can, when it's still raining and the grasses will, the prairie will green up, you can burn a section of land, remove the cured fuels, which have arguably very little or low nutrition, and you can encourage regrowth. If you burn a large swath and you encourage a lot of regrowth, you can bring the animals back to that area because the animals are going to select for high quality nutrition, mothers, calves, The buffalo are very attuned to the landscape, and they choose different vegetation by the hour. So you can bring them in, and then you can hunt them without having to walk many, many miles. So, of course, Native Americans lived hand in glove with the environment, and they knew how to bring the food to themselves, to them, to their tribes, to their villages. So that's just a small, simple story about how to manage the land and think about existing on the landscape using fire. A lot of people want to know about the methods and techniques for prairie restoration. A lot of times, what we do is we walk the site and to see what's available. We inventory the site. If it's mostly non-native, we might consider just starting from scratch. And that's what we did at the APLL. There were very few natives. The land had been fairly well disturbed over time, and we started from scratch. And then at that time you make a note of invasive species. Some invasive species are really scrappy, and they're gonna cause you some problems, so you're gonna need to make note of them, and you're gonna need to allot resources to highly invasive or problematic species, because they're gonna be there and they're gonna require extra resources. Then you can choose on how to remove the undesirable vegetation, and there's different methods. Tony Senio is a turf specialist, really. Athletics ground managers are really good at managing turf, athletic facilities, as you'd imagine. So he has his license and he knows how to apply herbicides. We did a small dance with the devil. We did go with the herbicides, as opposed to disking, tilling, or even solarization. I think our previous speaker, JD mentioned tarping. The $3 word, the fancy word is solarization. You can put down a tarp, and then you can use the sun's power to heat the soil underneath. You can kill the plants. You can, as JD said, you can kill the biology, but you can also destroy weed seed present in the soil as well. So I would argue solarization used appropriately can remove a lot of problem species. JD's correct, you'll have to rebuild the biology, but if you use native plants, they begin rebuilding the biology pretty quickly in that soil. So I have used solarization, but solarization tarps over 8 acres, pretty hard to do. So a lot of times you've got choices to make. You know how it is with time and labor and resources and students. So Tony was able to do that with me. The students didn't have to take part in that. I didn't want them to take part in that. And then he prepared the soil for us. Covered that. And then the students and volunteers did rake off what's called dead or cured biomass. One of the things you need to have is you need to have good soil to seed contact with prairie seed. It's not like carrots or tomatoes or other garden species where you kind of stick those seeds down an inch and then cover them with soil. Prairie seed likes to be covered lightly. I'm talking about a quarter to an eighth of an inch of soil raked lightly. So you need to, but you still need to have that that soil, seed to soil contact. If the prairie seed germinates in cured material, the small seedling tends to desiccate or dry out and you can kill them. So you do want to have that site prepared properly, and that means mineral soil exposed. So raking is a good thing. That's when we're starting a prairie. So there are some of my students and volunteers. tip of the hat to Megan Lenz, the undergrad I partnered with. By the way, Megan went off to get a Fulbright and go study in Norway. So, yep. It was a joy working with her. She was very helpful. This is the 1 acre area at the Ashton Cross Country Course. Tony sprayed it, and then the students are out there raking off the cured dead biomass to expose the mineral soil. Operating on a shoestring budget, that cost me $0. And the students were happy to learn, so that was fun. More of my students and volunteers, even a couple of, on the left is Matt. He's a grad student in geography, getting his PhD, so all types of student were helping. Let's see, back to the techniques and methods. Once you purchase the seed from a reputable nursery, and I advise you not to buy the cheapest product. You can go online and you can Google prairie seed, and you might find a great deal of prairie seed grown in, I don't know, let's say Montana. That might be the cheapest product. But and you might have beautiful plants like poppies, which aren't native to Iowa, in your initial mix. Within a few years, the plants that aren't acclimatized will fade. So you're essentially paying for plants that won't stay around. So I would say, I would encourage you to buy plant species that are native and endemic to your region, and that you'll have the highest degree of success. So just in this case, it's best not to buy the cheapest product. By the highest quality product. And there are a number of ways to sow the seed. And in this particular case, we didn't have access to machinery. I had access to students. And so I taught them how to hand broadcast. And what you do is you take some buckets and you mix it with a carrier, and then you mix the, you throw in some water, and you mix it up, and then you have the students divide up into groups, and then it's helpful to even divide the area up into lanes, and then you have them sow or hand broadcast the seed at the right time of year onto the mineral soil that's been prepared. And the good thing about sowing prairie seed is you can start in October, and you can go all the way up to April. Prairie seed doesn't mind being seeded during the dead of winter. I like to seed it when it's in contact with the mineral soil and it's covered by snow. That way my granivores or mice and other small creatures that love to eat seed aren't eating up my seed, the birds that can fly in. My seed is covered by snow, and then the snow and ice is actually a part of the process. Winter we think of as a nothing time, but in fact, in ecology, the big word is vernalization. The winter actually is very important for germination and other biological aspects of the prairie. For example, here the seed of prairie species are stratified and scarified by the winter process. Some plant species require the seed coat to be literally physically altered before they'll germinate. Some plant seed have to go through the gut of animals and be, and then the stomach acids of these animals have to affect the seed coat before they will germinate. Plants adapt and evolve to their locations, and they incorporate the climate into their biology. So prairie species are no different. The winter becomes an important process in germination. Some plants have to go through a number of cold days before they will leaf out again. We'll see more and more impact of the climate crisis on plants as these processes are affected. So gone over that. Here are my students seeding directly into the snow in April. And we had a great response. I said that it needed to be, the seed needed to come in direct contact with the soil. It is, because the freeze-thaw, the winter freeze-thaw incorporates the seed into the soil. Let's see. Here they are. The pink flags I put out because students can't walk in a straight line. yeah, this is the first time they probably ever. It used to be a skill that pioneer farmers and others would have, and they could sow a new field by hand and spread the seed out beautifully and accurately. It was a skill. It's a lost art to hand broadcast. So I'm teaching them again hand broadcasting. The carrying medium here is just sand. Prairie seed can be almost microscopic. If you try to throw it onto the soil and there's a slight breeze, it'll just blow away. So you need to have it attached to a little bit of sand, and then you can sling it out appropriately. There's a simple technique that I like teaching them, and you know, they pick it up quickly and they enjoy it. Here's a student hand broadcasting in the second phase or the 7.5 acre prairie. There's a little bit of cured vegetation on the ground, but there's enough mineral soil that the seed is incorporated into the soil, the mineral soil. Here they are having fun and acting out for the camera, hams. The equipment is pretty simple. Again, shoestring budget, just lots of various buckets and mixing the seed. Now, what I don't get with this technique is a precise coverage. I'm okay with a fairly imprecise spread of seed because I know that over time the plants will start to select their favorite sites. Plants do that. In tall grass prairies, the species that are at the top of the hill are different than the species that are at the bottom of the hill. From the top to the toe slope, if you will. And the plants begin to differentiate based on small gradations in geography and climate and rainfall. So they're pretty amazing. Prairie for me is a bit of a teacher and a muse. It's always changing, and if you're watching it, it's always teaching you. More on methods and techniques. What were some of the filters we applied, if you will, to the prairie at the Ashton Cross Country Course, or AXCC? We weren't allowed to go willy-nilly and just have our way with it. It's primarily, its first role or primary purpose is to be an athletic facility. So we had to accommodate that. And we applied some filters to the species that Megan and I chose. There were 100 or so species that we could have selected from and ordered seed for, but I needed to start applying these filters. The plant, mature plant height, the maximum plant height needs to be 4 feet or less. Some of the prairie species, if they're really loving it, they can be 12 feet tall. I couldn't have the parents, the visitors, who came out there to watch their athletes running around. I couldn't, you know, their view still needed to be, you know, free and clear. I couldn't obstruct their view. So that was the first, one of the first important filters. How am I doing on time, by the way? How much time do I have?
About
15 minutes. I need to keep moving. I wanted it to be wildflower heavy. I'm essentially creating a space that I want to be very pretty, so I selected for showy wildflowers. I also selected for wildflower the bloom time. I wanted flowers to bloom early on and then all the way through to the end of the growing season. If you just pick one flower, it might bloom for a couple of weeks and then you have no more pretty flowers. So you can start creating a matrix, a spreadsheet, and sort of applying these filters, and that helps you narrow down the original cast of characters or number of species to the appropriate level. The visitor interaction, I wanted to try to teach people about the species. We could also get free plants from the nearby remnants. And then scientific research would be important. How do you measure biodiversity? It's a great word. One way to do it, Andrew Forbes does it, is he collects winged insects in traps and he looks at population change in species. And then you can put a number to it and you can track biodiversity. In fact, that's what he's doing and has done since the beginning, the inception. Other filters are, could you purchase plugs or even gallon pots? But again, planting a large number of plants over 8 acres would be difficult to do. Seed was the best way to go. Bioregionally endemic, again, teaching students about paying attention to bioregions or plant communities. And then teaching them about geography, topography, bioregions, and plant communities was all part of the goal. Year one tended to be dominated by the plants that were colonizers. They came in quickly. They needed minimum germination time. Remember, I put seed down in April. So the plants that needed minimum germination time, like the black-eyed Susan, were up right away. Prairie restorationists talk about different phases of the prairie. The yellow phase tends to be the phase that occurs first, and those are the plants that tend to be colonizers. Plants, there's a scale of everything from colonizers to very conservative small C species that take a lot of time to develop. And it's about the plant's ability to exist on a site. And as, say, a site becomes dominated by a large root system or a plant that's really good at occupying that space because there's a lot of competition at the root level, the plant that can occupy that space and outcompete others tends to dominate that space, sort of basic ecology at play. So they're sorting themselves out as the prairie matures. Here's the yellow phase again. That little white thing is the tent that Andrew Forbes, insect trap that Andrew Forbes uses to collect insect species. His students have been identifying species since the beginning of the prairie. There it is in the distance. Here in 2022, the black-eyed Susans are beginning to fade and new plants are beginning to exert presence. Staying with methods and techniques, what do restorationists do after they put the seed on the ground? And I'd highlight this part of the restoration process because this is where a lot of failure occurs. We certainly know how to mow our lawns near our houses, adjacent our houses. That kind of mowing is not the right type of mowing. I use the term height-adjusted mowing. And what I use is a weed whacker. I use a professional-grade weed whacker, but I put on a metal blade and I mow the weed seed head off of the seed for the first 2 years. Gardeners call that deadheading. And I think about this part of the process is essentially something that's statistically driven. If I remove weed seed present for 2 years, then the population of the weed seeds is declining each year. And I'm not getting a new crop of seeds. And while I'm doing that, the perennial plants can spend their time creating their root system, and they can begin to dominate the site. And I can tip the scales to the perennials during those first 2 years. So height-adjusted mowing is a really important technique during the first 2 years of prairie restoration. I do that based on the weed seed pressure. I'm watching the seed heads of the weed seed, and I'm mowing them before the weed seeds are ripe. So if you mow the weeds and the seeds are already ripe, you've wasted your time. You need to mow the weed seed heads before they're ripe, and then they fall to the ground, and of course they're just incorporated into the soil. So you have to know your biology, you have to know your plants. That's all part of it, because getting to know your plants, getting to know the biology, I think is part and parcel of the whole thing. And then the number varies throughout the year. If I have a fantastic crop of weeds, then I'm mowing more often. It could be as small as one or two times. Sometimes if I have a large crop of weeds, it could be five times. When you mow the first time, they'll recover based on rainfall and sunshine. So it's an organic process. It requires you to pay attention, which I'm fine with. Then you get to do the fun thing in year three. You get to burn it. The burns in year three tend to be kind of wimpy. But as the vegetation improves, the prairie vegetation is actually made to burn, and it will burn beautifully, and it's made to burn through adaptation and requiring fire as part of the process to maintain prairie. Without fire, prairie converts to forest. Mowing tends to sap the plant's viability. If you mow prairie over a number of years, it'll lose its diversity. So fire is a necessary component. You need to know that right off the bat. It's a necessary component of prairie. And then, of course, watching out for invasive species. One of the things I learned about small pocket prairies, because most of the prairies we create are small pocket prairies, is that they're surrounded by an intense pressure of weeds. It's very difficult to create and maintain pocket prairies. There's just a constant pressure from outside, whether that be human traffic or bird traffic or vehicle traffic or mower traffic. We're not very good about cleaning our mowers before they leave one area and enter a prairie. So it's quite easy to spread unconsciously an invasive species or a problematic species into a prairie, because the mowers don't clean themselves regularly as they leave one area. It's not a practice that we see this more regularly when we think about lakes, ponds, how the species, invasive species, jump from one lake to the other because of the boats and trailers. We're aware of that. We struggle to do that because that requires a level of hygiene, I think, that's difficult to maintain. Last bit is into, I think, the BioBlitz. That's coming up. This is the time in which we engage the public in, and I think the university's at its best, absolute best, when it's engaging the public. It's not just something for students and faculty. It's really something amazing when it's in the community, doing its best work in the community. And that's what I think the BioBlitz does. Here's a few pictures of some of our pollinators and some of the flowers there. These are taken at the prairie. Here you see the yellow phase is over and starting to be dominated by some of the plants that have purple. The sea of white in the back is a fleabane, an annual fleabane. That typically comes in year one. You have a massive explosion of colonizer plants. They tend to fade over time as the perennials exert their power. And some of the benefits, of course, the soils. As JD said, healthy soils are the basis for healthy food systems as well as ecosystems. We talk about sequestering carbon. We talk about holding soils in place. We talk about increased stormwater infiltration. We talk about reducing the nutrient runoff and soil erosion. As JD said, that stuff tends to go downstream where we don't want it. Prairies, I tell my students, are like giant sponges. As JD said, the organic matter, the biology holds soil. The plants themselves, with their deep-rooted systems, transpire the rainwater. I think the number is, on a prairie, 70% of the rainfall is infiltrated and held on site. Currently, the way we build landscapes, 70% of the rainwater is shed. So we have it exactly opposite by design. So we'd like to change back to an older system that is, I think, more proven in terms of creating a healthy network ecosystem. And then we want to recharge our aquifers. We're draining our aquifers. Our aquifers are replenished through stormwater. So we need to do that. We know that native organisms are important, and the pollinators, for example. The genetic repository, that's really important. Migrating animals, I think our animals deserve a lot of respect and recognition. They need a place too. The unique, rare, and endangered organisms, once they're gone, they're gone. You've heard that. The untapped medicinal uses. I tell my students, what did Native Americans use for medicines and Band-Aids and all the ways in which they healed each other? You might or might not know that aspirin comes from willows, salicylic acid. There's many, many medicinal uses that are largely untapped, and we lose that potential when we lose those plants. Prairies require no artificial watering, fertilizers, herbicides, mechanical maintenance. Fire is the primary tool. And most importantly, reconnection to nature. We are sorely in need of that. Let's go to some of the pictures from BioBlitz. Students and family being interacting with the plants. There's Tony, nod to Tony, putting the sign out there. We've got a QR code. And then the fifth annual BioBlitz. This is coming up. How much time do I, am I out of time? I'm out of time, I'll click on that.
can't do it. How does this work? Won't do it. Did that work? I can't get it to work.
We can put it up.
Yep.
During the break.
Yep. Put it up there.
Some of those dates are older. I'll pull this slide up. That's an older date. That's a typo on my part. We'll pull this up.
Is it usually in July?
It's July 12th. Saturday.
That's 2024.
Yeah, that was an older, that was a typo on my part, but can we pull this up and then that'll.
Let's do questions and then we'll put it up.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Come on up, but don't need to raise your hand, just line right up.
So after the first burn, how often should you burn it?
It depends. Burning is challenging. The resources to burn can be significant. The experience can be significant. If you burn at a minimum every 3 to 5 years, you can get away with burning every year. Fire is a selective force. If you burn regularly, annually, it will exert a force on your prairie.
Okay.
So, yeah, how's that?
Excellent, thank you. I know farmers have done restored prairies, and there was a program for it. Is there any tax thing or grant people can get?
For prairies?
Prairie restoration.
The classic one is the CRP program. And that's through the NRCS Soil Service. You can enroll in the program and get a tax break for planting prairie on farms. Where farmers often struggle is burning tends to be one of the most expensive options, so they often will end up having to disc. And as JD said, disking destroys biology, so it's something we want to stay away from. It introduces weed species. It can be done. I think it's a labor of love and it's challenging, but I find it to be worth it.
Yeah, I was at the program last year. It was very good. Thank you. Will the hawks be here this year? The birds that were there last year?
I'm sorry, what'd you say? What do you mean?
They had hawks.
Oh. Oh, okay. Well, we have at the BioBlitz, we have multiple tables. And I think the birds will be again. Okay. Yeah.
And how long do you continually plant seeds?
There's the initial seeds. And then there's a technique called interseeding. You don't have to have all of your eggs in one basket. You don't have to purchase the very expensive seed all in one go. If you, you put in, say you can only afford 15 species, the more seeds, the more species, the better. But if you have only enough money for 15, you can go back in a few years and interseed, and those seeds will eventually show up. So you can always add more seeds to the prairie over time.
If you have a smaller place on your property to put in a smaller prairie,
yeah.
Is it better just to go to small plants and put them in plugs?
The small little pocket-sized prairies are the hardest. The smaller the size, the more likely one of the species will come to dominate. Prairie operated on a very large scale. So when you try to have a prairie in a very small scale, it doesn't really quite work. One of the hardest things to learn is which plants are the most, I'll call it well-behaved or least aggressive. A lot of trial and error occurs. You'll plant an area, you'll like a plant. You won't quite understand its biology. You'll put it in there and it comes to dominate that site. And you had in your mind a vision of, 50 beautiful plants over a small area, and only one plant comes to dominate. Why? Because we're asking a large-scale plant community to exist in a tiny postage stamp. We're asking for the impossible. So what really is useful is to find through trial and error and asking experts and others, what are the most well-behaved plants, AKA the least aggressive? And will those plants stay put? And will they not come to dominate that site? Then you can plant those plants. And I like doing that, planting 1 gallon plants or seedlings of non-aggressive plants, and that will sort of maintain the aesthetic that you want. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Yep.
When you chose the seeds for the mm-hmm. Ashton, did you have to have less allergenic ones?
She asked about plants that are allergenic or create allergies. There's a lot of myth around allergy-producing plants. For example, ragweed tends to get thrown into one large bucket, but we have multiple species of native ragweed. The giant or tall ragweed does not produce the pollen that creates an allergic reaction. It's the small one or small ragweed. So I think without going into too much, the plants that create allergy problems are, I don't know the full answer on those, but I haven't had that many problems. So I'm sorry, I can't give you a great answer.
Excellent answer. One more? Thank
you. Hi, you mentioned that you collected some seed from prairie remnants.
Yep.
I was wondering where the remnants were.
Yep. One remnant in particular is at Mormon Handcart Park. It's on the University of Iowa property, so I got permission to collect seed from that remnant. That was the main remnant I used.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you
ready
for,
can you come to the mic? Because otherwise the online people can't hear you.
So I was told by someone who has a prairie mm-hmm. that burning really is not necessary. So if you don't burn over an extended period of time, does that deplete your prairie? Or can you just not burn?
What I have found is birds will continually bring in weed seed because they're ingesting, whether that be seed from invasive or exotic shrubs, or roses or anything, the birds are ingesting that food, and then they'll come and sit in the prairie and excrete those seeds, and you'll constantly get woody invaders. You can mow those things, but woody invaders are not killed by mowing, as we know. They respond by producing more roots. Eventually, you lose the battle to woody invaders, and not only that, mowing harms some perennial plants. So I've observed the loss of diversity and damage from mowing, which is the main technique they would use for a prairie to maintain it. Also, all of the cured vegetation in a prairie is utilized by non-native or by native insects as homes. So when you mow, and we have a tendency or proclivity to want neat and tidy landscapes, all those choices to remove vegetation means that we're impacting beneficial insects because they're using that cured vegetation as homes to overwinter. So we're going to see less of our Luna moths, less of our butterflies, less of those beneficial insects when we remove that vegetation. Fire is the main way in which we keep woody invasives at bay, and we also keep the prairie happy. It's just the thing that it's adapted to the best, without going in it too deeply. So I would disagree. If I want a high quality, high diverse prairie that's doing the maximum for the environment, I'm going to be using fire at the appropriate level and time.
Thank you. big round of applause again. Thanks so much.